Do spirits exist, and if so, can they play an essential role in our individual and collective lives? A question that Dr. Gary Schwartz continues to chase. Great research. We're going to talk about his work, The Sacred Promise, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Gary Schwartz, PhD, professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery at the University of Arizona, also director of its Laboratory for Advances in Consciousness and Health. His research integrates mind-body medicine, energy medicine, and spiritual medicine as well. Accomplished author, in addition to his many works. And here he is, Dr. Gary Schwartz, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Wonderful, thanks. And how are you?
Good. Looking forward to this. It's been,
me too.
Been a couple of years for you, hasn't it, on the program?
It has been a couple of years. And you know, one of the things that's so wonderful about your show, as you know, you're one of the few that actually take a significant amount of time to talk about exciting, you know, areas of work and opportunity and challenge and so on.
Well, you know, I think in-depth is so important. You know, people really want to digest a subject, whatever it is.
Right.
And, you know, you just can't do it justice in a half hour or so.
Exactly. Really, you know, it was really special. I just have to acknowledge this right in the beginning. Is that today was the official day that the Sacred Promise book was being published. And coincidentally, it just so happened that it worked out that on the day that it was being born, so to speak, was the day that the night that I got to appear with you on this show. So the first generally public discussion about this is probably going to be the most in-depth conversation about it.
And it's a 1-11-11.
And it's a 1-11-11. Isn't that wonderful?
I like that. Gary, tell to the many new listeners who've joined us since you were last on 2008, tell us a little bit more about yourself other than the bio. I mean, how did you get interested in investigating science with the spirit world? What were the issues that got you that far?
Well, that's a great question. How far back do we go? I mean, in some
you go back to the little boy of Gary Schwartz.
The little boy of Gary Schwartz. I had a feeling you were going to say that. Well, the little boy of Gary Schwartz was actually fascinated by two things. He was fascinated by science, and I had multiple laboratories in my basement and nature, and I used to collect all kinds of animals and read the Book of Knowledge and so on. There was my, you know, science and engineering side. And then I was also a musician. I played actually. By the time I was 12, I had played 12 different instruments because I grew up in a musical household. I had a natural talent. When I was 13, I picked up the electric guitar, and that was just when the era when rock and roll was beginning, and I was ready, so to speak, you know, fairly accomplished, and so I immediately started even playing professionally in a rock and roll band. It actually became quite a big one on Long Island at the time. And, of course, electric guitar is a funny kind of instrument because it's bridging science, electronics, sound, vibration, energy, of course, with music, with you know, with the mind and with human performance. So, but I would have to say that there was nothing consciously spiritual about me at all. I mean, I grew up in a basically in what I affectionately refer to as an Orthodox agnostic home, you know, sort of a Reformed Jewish home.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by Orthodox agnostic was that it didn't matter what the question was. You know, is there gravity or is there God? Sort of the philosophy, particularly my father, sort of inspired me was the idea that was the approach was that my response was, I don't know, could be yes, could be no, show me the data, I'm open. On the other hand, my parents believed that it was ashes to ashes, dust to dust, case closed. I mean, there was nothing about like survival of consciousness after death. The idea of angels, well, they were in the same category as Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. And then, of course, I went off to undergraduate school and then eventually graduate school at Harvard, and there the culture was very, you know, atheistic, very materialistic.
Sure. Yeah.
And so by that time I was pushed really far away from the possibility of a greater spiritual reality. And it's kind of amusing, I mean, and kind of wondrous about how I was sort of led to do this kind of work. And I've ultimately came to the conclusion that it was circumstances that itself involved a greater spiritual reality.
When you were last on with me, I think we were talking about your latest work at the time, the GOD, the God experiments, I mm-hmm. think. Wasn't that it?
I can't remember whether it was the God experiments or the energy healing experiments, actually. Okay. It was one or the other.
This one, the Sacred Promise, what's this one about?
This one is by far the most, I think, important, challenging, visionary, controversial, fun, significant books that I've ever had the privilege to write, because this is a book that I didn't plan to write, that I had great trepidations about publishing, because it addresses these two fundamental questions. One, is spirit real? Is there a greater spiritual reality? How would we know? How could science actually take us to this question? But the second thing, the more important one, is the question of, if a spiritual reality exists, can and does spirit play a role in our individual and collective lives? And is that the critical step that we have to come to acknowledge if we're ultimately going to not only have a more complete sense of what reality really is, i.e. the new paradigm, but also that's going to be what's going to be critical for helping to solve the major problems that we face as a species and our planet, because in part we're living in an incomplete world, and we can't do it alone. We may really need the assistance of a greater spiritual reality. That's why the subtitle, How Science is Discovering Spirit's Collaboration with Us in Our Daily Lives, is a very bold statement.
This obvious involvement by spirit, mm-hmm. why does that happen? I mean, do we summon it? Do we ask for the help? Or do they decide, let's help this person?
By the way, I know your listeners know this, but one of the great joys would be that having a conversation with you is you ask such great questions, okay? That's a wonderful question.
That's because we have great guests who can give you the answers.
No, it's definitely a two-way street, let me tell you. Okay. I mean, I think it's nice that I'm part of the loop. Anyway, getting back to your question. The conclusion that I've come to, and I've come to this by evidence, some of which we'll talk about tonight. I've come to it partly by sheer logic, reasoning, and I've also come to it by direct personal experience, which in my own life I approach as a scientist. And the conclusion is basically as follows, and that is that, quote, spirit, the broad meaning of spirit, which is mostly things that we can't, quote, see with our mm-hmm. conventional senses, and is very much essentially akin to energy and information. A sidebar for the second, you know, with our eyes, for example, which are brilliant, and we see all the millions of colors and all the complexity and beauty that we see, which fills our consciousness, the truth is that what our eyes see is only an absolute minuscule spectrum of all the frequencies that are actually present in the universe. And in fact, I use the example that if we imagine the full spectrum of photons that exist in a room right now, and we imagine that to be the size of the Empire State Building, and then we ask what percentage of those frequencies we actually can see with our eyes, it turns out the size that we see relative to the Empire State Building, over 100 stories high, is around the size of a grain of sand or the thickness of the paint on the wall. So most of it's invisible. Now, all of that invisible energy, and by extension, invisible spirit, which is all there,
sure.
It's still present. And so another metaphor that I've used is I say that, what if spirit is like air or water, meaning that it's always around us, it's essential for our very existence. We're, without thinking about it, breathing it in, breathing it out. And just like air or water, even though it's there all the time and we're getting assistance all the time, the truth is, just like we can learn to breathing exercise, for example, and learn how to meditate and learn how to breathe to play an instrument or to be in a sport, we can learn to invite spirit in. We can learn to attract the right kind of spirit and therefore enhance our conscious awareness of an involvement with this greater spiritual or energetic reality.
Was the spirit world, Gary, always there in tandem with the physical?
Wow, what a great question. Now, let me approach this by going about the way we were typically educated to believe this, I'm talking about in Western science, versus where that science is now leading us. If you would, the old idea, the conventional idea, was that basically we live in a physical world, a material world, and that's what's primary. And that even our consciousness is actually a byproduct. It's a, if you would, an invention or a side effect of the physical world. So the physical world comes first, and then, if you would, energy and information and mind come later. That's what's called the materialist perspective. But now what's happening is, of course, a little over 100 years ago with Einstein and E equals mc squared, we began to understand that matter was really energy and energy was really matter. So one could be converted into the other. And therefore, what we call matter is really, quote, organized energy. And of course, we now know matter is mostly empty space. Then, however, the big step was the realization that actually what's primary is energy. And energy is created by matter. And what matter is actually a special state, a crystallized, if you would, or more stabilized energy. So from this perspective, if energy is primary and matter is a special case of energy, and of course what we mean by spirit is what we also mean by energy, and is then we come to the conclusion that spirit was always here first. And matter is actually ultimately a product of spirit or a product of energy. One last point, food for thought. And that is, the materialist perspective is essentially that material creates intention, mm-hmm. because material creates consciousness. But this post-materialist perspective, as Dr. Lisa Miller, who's a professor at Columbia, calls it, this post-materialist perspective, in that perspective, actually, we have it backwards. It's actually intention that comes first, and intention creates matter. So just like, you know, we used to think that the sun revolved around the earth, and it was obvious, and everybody believed that, and it turned out it was wrong, we had it backwards.
Well, way backwards.
Way backwards. Well, I think we've got this one way backwards, too. And that shift in thinking is it's more transformative. It's more dramatic, a paradigm shift. It's more thinking about the world in an entirely new way than the paradigm shift of the Copernican Revolution.
When you were talking about the reasons why you believe the spirit world exists and mm-hmm. the evidence out there, does faith play a part in that, Gary?
Well, you know, well, again, thank you for asking such deep questions right up front. I trust that your audience appreciates that you're like this and that they want to hear these answers themselves.
I just hope I don't run out of them by the time our interview is up.
Well, you know, we always have the opportunity. First of all, you don't run out of them.
No,
and at this rate, we'll be going for a very long time. No. Okay. Getting back to the faith question. It actually doesn't require faith at all. Faith is something that, from my perspective, I call it actually evidence-based faith. And let me explain what I mean by that, if I might.
Sure.
Because it's also the metaphor, I even have a chapter called The Gravity of Spirit that introduces this all. You know, I or you, we could take a pen, or in Newton's day it was an apple, and if we let it go and we're on the earth, it will fall to the ground. And every time I've done that experiment, I've done it thousands of times, the pen falls. And I do this for students in my class. And I'll tell them, I say, you know, whenever I lose faith in humanity or lose faith in nature, I begin to question things, I drop things. And every time I've done the experiment in my physical form, it's fallen. Now, I know that in space, you know, with the absence of what we call gravitational force, or not really absence, but reduction, that it's not going to act that way. And I'm certainly open to the possibility that somebody with their mind could slow it down or, of course, even reverse it, and maybe it doesn't operate this in other parts of the universe. But all I know is that when I do the experiment, I let go of the pen, it falls. I can put my faith in that. I can put my trust in it, meaning faith, based on the evidence. You know, if I go to sleep at night, my mind may be in another universe. But I never have to worry that when I wake up in the morning, my body's going to be floating out the window.
Yeah.
My body is still in bed, my physical body. So in that sense, evidence takes us to faith. Now, that kind of faith is a science-based faith. as opposed to just we're told to take things on faith.
Somebody
in authority says,
right,
this is the way it is, and this is what you need to do. Yep. Now, so that's where the scientist says we should all be self-scientists, which is what I talk about in this book. We should all be practicing science applied to ourselves, because then we can make phenomenal discoveries that only we ourselves can make. Now, the last comment about this, about the faith side, though, is, which is wonderful about that we can have faith, is that the positive side of faith is that when we lack, when we have insufficient evidence, faith is sort of what keeps us going.
That's what kicks in.
That's what kicks in. That's what keeps us going when we're in a question state. And since most of the time we are in a question state, very few things are 100% like gravity.
Well, that's true.
Then we have to act on inference. And so what I recommend is that we develop the new, if you would, science-based spirituality, is that we don't give up faith. In fact, we recognize the power of faith. But what we do is we do it mindfully. We do it discerningly. And we don't do it with a closed mind. We do it with an open mind.
I'm convinced that people with the faith are happier.
Yes. And what's, and you know what happens when they're really happy? Is when that faith is an evidence-based faith. So it's not just a faith that is that they're taking on faith.
Right.
But it's a faith that they have a reason to believe in. It's a faith that they've seen evidence for. In fact, one of the things that occurred to me after I wrote this book is that the Sacred Promise book is actually an evidence-based hope book. It provides evidence in the hope for all of this. And what that takes you to is increasing peace and gratitude and fascination and awe and trust and inspiration. It's in many respects a comforting philosophy, even though it also opens you to the possibility of that there's a negative side to all of this, too.
True. And we're going to get into that part,
sure,
too. You called it the Sacred Promise. What does that mean?
That's a very important question, because both the words sacred and promise are significant. And let's take the promise part first.
Okay.
The promise part, promise has two meanings. First of all, this promise as in potential. You know, we say this is a promising avenue to explore. The promise is in the looking toward the future. It has hope. It has promise. So one of the things that I talk about with one of the meanings of the Sacred Promise is essentially that science has the promise to actually prove that all this is more than real or discover that it's not. So it's not that science can't address these questions. Quite the contrary, what this book reveals is that science can address these questions. And not only that, when you look at all the evidence in total, the promise is that it's going to take us to a greater spiritual reality. But it's a promise. It's a prediction. It's a possibility. Mm-hmm. That's one meaning of promise. But the second meaning of the promise is really is equally important, and that's promise as in commitment. It's promise as in contract.
My word.
It's my word. So, for example, which is another meaning which I talk about in the book, if I'm going to show up in the laboratory and invite spirit, for example, to come into a chamber where I've got very sensitive equipment to detect their presence, they've got to promise to show up, meaning if I'm going to be there, they're going to be there. And if I don't know that there are certain individuals on the other side that have a commitment to showing up, even though it's a hypothesized commitment, if they're not going to make a commitment, a responsibility to be there, at least be as responsible as the us physical experiment is, I'm not going to waste my time.
Good point.
So there's that matter. Then there's the question of sacred. Now, sacred's a really interesting term. It's one, by the way, that I've never used before. In all of my years of writing, and before that as a kid, the word sacred was not in my vocabulary.
Gary, we're going to take this break, and I want to get back and talk about sacred in full, in detail, as we talk with Dr. Gary Schwartz, The Sacred Promise, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating discussion. Wait till you get into some of the stories behind The Sacred Promise. And we're with Dr. Gary Schwartz. Gary, we were talking about the sacred, that portion of your book. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, as a professional scientist for all these years, a word that, of course, doesn't come up in my vocabulary is sacred. And one of the things I came to realize was that this promise of both possibility and commitment from science and from the greater spiritual reality, because that was the conclusion that the book was coming to, that this promise was not just an individual promise. It was not just a collective promise. It was a, quote, sacred promise. And the word sacred has a couple of meanings here, because one of the implications of a sacred promise is the notion that it's serious, that this is a real commitment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a promise. Like, you know, people get married, and in the old days, people would say, till death do us part. But
that's
when
right.
they made that contract, I mean, today, anyone who says that, they really, that's not what a marriage license means.
No.
It just means we'll be together for as long as it's comfortable for us, and we like each other. And then it's okay, no fault divorce, we'll move on. So that promise is no longer a sacred promise. It's anything. It's an empty promise. So this was, first of all, it was very serious. It was sincere. But on top of that is the notion that some things can be so reverential, can be so fundamental, so core, so universal, so cherished, that they end up taking us to the idea of a great spirit, or a universal mind, or a Yahweh, or a God, or an Allah, or a source. You know, whatever words you wish to use for a oneness. The implications of this book, and I take people to this, but that's going to be really explored even in more and further books, is the notion that there really is this kind of sacred process going on, and we can discover it in our personal lives as scientists, not just in the laboratory of the university, but the laboratory of our personal lives.
And both are important, aren't they?
Yes. Each one are important, and together they're more powerful than either one alone. Then they both need each other.
This the science of the laboratory, what are they doing to try to prove the existence of the other side?
Well, there are various kinds of research. There, one area, for example, which I do not talk about in the Sacred Promise, is work that's continuing on near-death experiences. And as you know, this is when people are close to death and their brains are literally, quote, dead, meaning that there's no EEG function and so on. And yet people are having conscious experiences of a very profound nature. And then they're brought back to life, for example, their hearts are restarted. And then they come back and they recount these experiences and they're transformed as a result. And this is very difficult to explain in any other way except that there's something going on that the mind doesn't require a brain to function, and there's much more in the universe than we're currently aware. So that's one area of research. Second area of research, which I talk about a fair amount in The Sacred Promise, is research on mediumship, on mediums who can connect with the other side. But in this book, what I talk about is that there are sort of professional mediums who do this kind of thing, and then there's also people in their own personal lives who start having these kinds of intuitive moments, they have these experiences, and they're not, if you would, general mediums, because they can't read anybody, but for their own particular loved ones, they develop a special relationship.
And it works for them.
And it works for them, and we'll talk about that, some very dramatic stories. But the third example, the one which I'm most excited about, and which I reveal for the first time in this book, is that science is creating new technologies to make it possible to detect the tiniest amount of energy. So, for example, and again, we'll talk about this, there's a device called the silicon photomultiplier system, which detects single photons of light in utter pitch darkness, and you can track them precisely, which is utterly extraordinary.
Almost like night vision goggles, probably way better.
Oh, no. It's so far beyond night goggles. It is like night goggles, but to an extreme.
Right.
And I want to
get
to a metaphor of that in a second since you brought it up. So thank you. And anyway, and using this kind of technology, with the latest solid-state physics and the latest in circuitry and the latest in computers, we can actually use this to not only detect the presence of spirit, that is, collaborating spirit from the other side, what we now call our Sacred Promise team. But also, these devices have the promise, and we'll get to that at some point, about the soul phone, to be actually converted into technology. That we're having what I call a Wright Brothers moment in science again in these areas. So these are very exciting times. Now, talking about night goggles is beautiful. So if I could just share one thing, because this was a huge take-home lesson to me while I was a professor at Yale, and it's become really salient now. And it's perfect since your show is at night. You know, we look up at the sky at night, particularly if we're in a sky without a moon. There's no moon in the sky right now. It's cloudy. You know, there's no clouds, and we're away from the city. You know, like in the woods or near the ocean, if you're away from the city.
Right.
And we can see thousands of stars with the naked eye, and with telescopes, of course, we can see billions of stars and billions of galaxies. And all that light is present in the quote vacuum of space, and it's outrageously complex, and it goes into our tiny little pupils. Okay. Very hard to fathom how all this can occur, but it does. Now, during the day, we look up in the sky, the same sky, and let's say there's no clouds, no moon, of course. We look up, and what we see is blue, not a single star. And the question is, what happened to all that starlight? Did it merely, quote, disappear, or is it all still there? It's just that we're blinded by the closest star in our vicinity, which, of course, is what we call the sun. So the take-home message, the soundbite, is sometimes you have to go into the dark in order to see the light. Sometimes you have to go into the dark in order to see the light. And that's what we're doing now with contemporary technology. And that's also what people do when they meditate, and when people go into trances. And when people get away from all the wondrous and crazy lives that we live with, filled with all of this external sensation, you know, light and sound and touch and taste and so on. We go into a super quiet state. It's like we're going into the darkness. And then we have the capability to see the more subtle information that's there all around us, but during the day we don't notice.
Gary, you had John Edward write your foreword.
That's correct.
He's one of our world-renowned mediums.
Right.
Was it difficult getting to him? Are you friends with him?
Well, John is a very busy. John's a very busy person, and we email each other. I don't know, maybe twice a year, just to say hello, because John was one of the first mediums that I had the privilege to work with, and he was really devoted to research. And he was very public about his devotion to research. In fact, he participated in the first three major experiments that I did, which were published in the Afterlife Experiments book. And it was he and his guide, supposedly, because he called me from an airport. And he said, Gary, my guides are telling me that you've got to write a book. You've got to write it now. In fact, I started writing the Afterlife Experiments book because John insisted upon it. I mean, I didn't do it just because he said it, but I did it because I knew that he was right, that the story needed to be told, the data were too important, they needed to be collected and put forth in a way that people could understand, and so on. So anyway, John played a very pivotal role. Now, we're not, quote, friends like family. We don't go out and play together. We haven't done anything professionally in a long time. But we still sort of stay in contact. And John knows the kind of person I am because he's followed the work over the years. He was with me from the beginning.
He obviously respects you.
Well, apparently, because you read the foreword, it's very laudatory and very compelling. So I'm really honored that he feels the way he does and said the way things that he does. But he can put it into a perspective of someone who's been on the front line, someone who's truly gifted, someone who is an evidence-based medium, evidence-based psychic. He's a bulldog for truth. I mean, he wants to know the facts. And so it was a privilege to have him. And also, he believes in a greater spiritual reality. I mean, he's not just talking to the deceased. And that's a wonderful thing, that our consciousness continues like the light from distant stars. But he also believes in the greater spiritual reality, including guides and angels and all of that. And he was one of the people who pushed me to start doing research in this area. And he also believes in the sacred, the source, the universal consciousness.
Well, let me read just a portion of what he wrote.
Sure.
It says, this book forces the readers to examine their own life experiences and question them and take responsibility for their thoughts and actions. It enables you to live a life that is unfolding with assistance from the invisible elephant in the room known as spirit. So he hits it right on the head.
Yeah, but in fact, thank you for for reminding me that, because it really is the invisible elephant in the room. And it's not just the imagined elephant, it's the real elephant.
Well, you know, I was reading that portion, and I was thinking about Harry Houdini as he made the elephant disappear in the Hippodrome in the UK. And lo and behold, you may be in touch with Harry Houdini.
Yes, and I didn't
Weird.
Yes, that is outrageously weird, and leave it to you to see the connection. By the way, that's one of the great things about being able to do things in depth with people who care about depth, is that they're as much a teacher as they are a listener.
Yeah.
So thank you. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Harry, since you brought him up with regard to the elephant and making the elephant disappear, and John Edward talking about the elephant in the room. Harry Houdini was actually sort of a hero of mine when I was a child. I was fascinated with magic and so on. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie.
The Tony Curtis movie?
Yes.
Absolutely. Loved it.
You loved it. Okay, well, I loved it too as a kid. Now, later, much later, I learned that Harry Houdini had a deep interest in this whole question of life after death. And he, along with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, they developed a very special friendship. Now, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle became a spiritualist. He became convinced that the evidence was sufficiently strong that there was a greater spiritual reality. Harry Houdini really wanted to believe that there was a greater spiritual reality, but he was also aware that there were a lot of frauds. And there are frauds today.
And he was out to expose them.
And he was out to expose them, and he did.
Yeah.
And he revealed, a lot of these. But he was not just out to become famous for being a fraud detector. He was really searching to find someone who was genuine, because he really wanted to believe that his mother's essence, her consciousness and energy, still existed. So, and they had this friendly debate about this, okay? Now, I learned about this as an adult.
And he was almost obsessed with it.
I would say he was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
I think that's very well put. And I suspect he would agree with us. In fact, someday we're going to ask him. And I'm going to blame it on you. I'm going to say, hey, George mentioned this on the radio. He brought up the connection. Can you give us an answer? So anyway, now let's go to the present.
And he'll say, they still have radios in those days?
That's very funny. Okay, so present day. A couple of years ago, here I am now dealing with all this secret material, which is being revealed in the Sacred Promise for the first time. There's all this stuff going on, including celebrities getting to me via mediums. Now, by the way, just a sidebar here before we talk about Harry, is that, it's difficult enough for most people, especially scientists, to imagine that our mothers or grandmothers or children who have gone before us, their consciousness is still here. But we find it even more difficult to imagine that somebody who's famous, be they quote, distinguished, like an Einstein, or infamous, like some other celebrities, that they're still here.
Right, right.
We find it even more difficult to imagine that, light travels for millions or billions of years, and the reason why we can see stars at night is because that information travels and it doesn't lose its integrity in the vacuum of space, the quote, vacuum of space. So millions or billions of years is nothing for a photon, okay? Now, given that that's the case, the same thing should apply to our photons. So consequently, it shouldn't matter whether we're talking to somebody, let's say Einstein, or Isaac Newton, or Pythagoras. It doesn't matter who the person is. What's a couple of thousand years for a photon?
Nothing.
Nothing. So therefore, the notion that historic figures, not only could their consciousness exist, but that they could care enough about the continued evolution of humanity and this planet to have made a sacred commitment to continue to be of assistance, the fact that that could be the case, which seems almost unimaginable to us, and it's such a beautiful thought. But it's plausible, okay? So I had to become open to all of this. And I confessed earlier on in the book, and we'll probably get to this, in that, I start with the question of, if Einstein's mind still exists, how would he prove that he's still here? Put yourself in Einstein's shoes. And the reason is because multiple mediums for years have been telling me that Einstein was coming to them, that he had messages for humanity, and he had some specific messages for me. And I had a difficult enough time accepting that my adopted grandmother, Susie Smith, was coming through. But Einstein, he wants to talk to me? Anyway, Harry Houdini. So all of this is going on. And then synchronicities started happening related to Harry Houdini. And I began to wonder, is he here too? And so I then started doing some secret science, meaning I did it privately. I did it as a research, in a thorough research manner. But it was done, for example, in the privacy of our home. And what I did was with a senior colleague and also my beloved, Ron Eklund Schwartz, we actually had a research medium, for example, come to the house, and we did a what's called a single-blind experiment where we actually asked the deceased Susie Smith to bring some secret people to the reading. So the medium had to contact Susie, and Susie had to bring Harry.
Huh.
All right? And then what we did was we had the medium had to read Susie, and then Susie had to pass on this person, and then the medium had to connect with this person. And I'm not going to go through all this now. We have a paper that's been submitted for publication about this, and hopefully we'll know soon about this. But anyway, it was a pair of readings. In this set of readings, the evidence was amazing about the evidence in favor of the fact that Harry Houdini was actually here. But of course, a mediumship reading, even if it's done under triple blind conditions, you're still going to question it. You're going to still wonder, well, is it really the mind of the experimenter? I mean, what's causing this? There are alternative paranormal explanations. That's where the technology comes in. Because when I started using, for example, these silicon photomultiplier systems, and we published our first paper on this a few months ago in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, if you read that paper, which is available at drgaryschwartz.com, and more importantly, it's in the book, The Sacred Promise, in a much more readable form. In the paper, it's really funny, I gave everybody initials. I didn't say who the alleged spirits were. But the editor found it hard to follow. So he said, can't you use names?
Use the names, yeah.
So what I did was I used the names without identifying them. So what I pointed out was that in the second, there were three sets of experiments. In the second experiment, one of the two spirits, alleged spirits, was, scientists always say a legend or a hypothesized or, you know, spirits. It was said Harry. Of course, they didn't know it was Harry Houdini. It was Harry.
Yeah.
So if I said it was Harry Houdini, they probably would have rejected the paper. So I said it was Harry. And then in the third experiment, which was the proof of concept experiment about whether this could be used as a communication device, I chose Harry. You know why?
Okay.
Because he was so good. The data indicated that he had extraordinary capability, more than virtually any of the alleged spirits that we had tried and, you know, initially tested.
Well, you know, he was so obsessed with trying to find out if it existed, he's probably equally obsessed to let us know it does.
Yes, and also he was a perfectionist in life. He practiced his art over and over. He was a master of disguises, a master of getting escape artist. He had tremendous strength. And you know what I always say is that people who are bigger than life in this life are bigger than life in the next. In other words, your personality and qualities continue. As well. Of course, they can grow and change, but they also continue. So if anybody is going to come through in spades, we would hypothesize that it would be Harry Houdini. Now, the last thing about this is, that, and you have to understand, as a scientist, I'm always skeptical about this, not as in the debunking or dismissing skepticism, which is not real skepticism, but in the skepticism, which is true skepticism, which is questioning.
Let's get into that, the questioning of this whole test, when we come back.